All right, Hockey Toolkit listeners, thank you very much for joining us. We got Bob Turo on with us. Bob Turo is a lifer in the game of hockey, everything from operations to scouting to playing to even being commissioner and running leagues of his own. So welcome to the podcast, Bob Turo.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me.
So, you're a lifer in the game. We've had a lot of great recent guests like Gene Binda and Toby O'Brien and some great guys who really have a tremendous background in the game and have some great stories. Can you just shed some light to our listeners about your background in the game and what brought you to this place now where you're at?
Well, I'm a dual citizen of Canada and the United States. I grew up in Kitchener, Ontario, played all my minor hockey in Kitchener, Ontario. I was a pretty good player. Maybe could have been a lower end Division I player, but when I was at the Kitchener Ranger camp and Paul Coffey skated past me like I was standing still, I remember going out to the car with my father and saying, there's no way I'm going to make any money being a player. I'm going to have to figure out how to stay in this game another way. And I mean, there were some other really good players at that camp. I mean, they had like 11 guys that went on to play in the NHL, guys like Al McGinnis and Brian Bellows and just Hockey DB back in those days. They were pretty good. And you could just tell I'm a realist. And I started coaching. I played for the Kitchener Ranger B team for like, I don't know, 8 games or something. It wasn't where I wanted to be. I wanted to play in the OHL, and I knew that it was going to be a while for me to get to the OHL. I wasn't prepared to wait until I was 18 or 19 or 20 years old or whatever. And I just started coaching, and coaching got me into administrative. I started working tournaments for Kitchener Minor Hockey and teaching clinics for them. When I was 22, I was coaching the Bantam AAA team. And then I got into scouting with the Sioux Greyhounds. And while I was scouting with the Sioux Greyhounds in the Ontario Hockey League, scouts go where players are. And at that point in time, something new was coming that I would never even consider. I'm 61 years old right now when I was playing hockey, and that is spring hockey. It's the norm now. But back in the day, when your team was eliminated, you put your skates away and you did something else. You played baseball or soccer or golf or, whatever it was. And I had run tournaments for Kitchener Minor Hockey, and there were players at these tournaments, but they were very poorly organized. And I said, if these parents are going to put their kids in spring hockey, and it was the elite kids that I was really interested in, I'll start a hockey tournament. So I started a hockey tournament in 1995. That probably is my biggest thing in hockey. Forget about the USHL. Forget about, the OHL. Forget about the USPHL. Where it was just literally the best kids in North America. And for 17 years, I did that. I don't want to say anybody made it to where they were because of the tournament, but what I'm about to tell you speaks to the quality of the tournament. You could not get in. It was not one of these spring tournaments where if you have a check, you get in. Okay? We all know those camps. We all know those tournaments. There were, on the 17 years, there were 6,000 kids that went on that played in the events that went on to play Division I hockey. There were 5,000 that went on to play in the CHL. There were over a thousand that went on to play in the National Hockey League. There were 9 first overall picks. I mean, the first one was Thornton, but go to Crosby, go to Kane. I mean, just DiPietro, just go down the list. I mean, they were there. And in 2010, I decided that I would sell it. And that was at the end of a 5-year term with the USHL. Gino Gasparini, who was the commissioner at the time in 2004, came to me. And this was, the USHL is a big time league right now. It's the number one league in the US for sure. And, but at the time, it wasn't much better than the EJ. Like, you ask Peter Masters or any, Sean Tremblay, they never lost a player to the USHL back in 2000. I remember I took a Tier 2 team to the CompuWare Tier 2 tournament, and there were OJ teams, there were USHL teams, there were NHL teams, and there really wasn't much of a difference between the NHL and the USHL back then. But when they created Tier 1 in the USHL, they were starting to pull away. And then in 2004, the development team left the NHL. CompuWare decided to fold their tent because he had, you know, he was owning an NHL team right now at that point in time, and he owned an OHL team. And so there was quite a bit of a separation at that point in time. And Gasparini, they wanted to get younger. They knew because of my hockey tournaments that I knew who all the young players were. So we started USHL Central Scouting. The combines were a part of that. We called them showcases at the time. The combines that are around for the USHL right now are the combines that Gino, Josh Mervis, and myself started back in 2005. So in 2010, my contract ended with the USHL. I sold prospects. I got out of hockey, and then I had a knock on my door in COVID asking me if I wanted to help the USPHL. I had never worked at that level of hockey before. The talks continued, and before you knew it, I was the commissioner. I was back in hockey as the commissioner of the USPHL, which was a great experience, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. So I've kind of been around the block. Like I said, I'm 61 years old. I've seen all the leagues now. I sit on the board of a club hockey, one of the three bodies now that are in club hockey. So I've seen not just the Division One level and Division Three level, but I've seen the club level now. I mean, the only level that I haven't really worked at is the National Hockey League, and all have been great experiences. I've met wonderful people, and it's been a great life.
Well, that's a great segue into the next question. Is like, you know, what in your experience was the most rewarding part of that journey? What was the most rewarding, whether it was a player or creating a league or is pushing programs to the next level? What was the most rewarding part of your journey in hockey thus far?
I don't know. I don't know if I could single one thing out. Like I remember when I was working for the Sioux, when I first started working for the Sioux, I was not the head scout at the time. And, you sit far away from where the decisions are made at the table. And, you know, when you're getting to the 13th round, now the OHL has 15 rounds. At the time, they would go, God, we'd go to 20 rounds until people didn't have room on their protected list. And so, you know, around 13, the general manager would come to you and say, you know, throw you a bone, basically, right? And so we drafted a kid by the name of Ben Schust, who you would never have heard of before, but he ended up being the captain of the Sioux Greyhounds, somebody in the 13th round who you just never expected. And he was never an NHL player, but you would never expect him to, you know, to get to that level. I mean, so that was really rewarding. Having all the kids come to prospects and just being around the hockey world. Like I remember, and they're not called Newport Sports anymore, but I mean, the biggest player agency in the world at hockey was Newport. They're called something different now. I can't remember what they are, but it was Don Meehan and Pat Morris. And I remember at the time, there really wasn't a lot of money in the game. And Pat Morris, who's like one of the most successful agents in the game, was the runner for Don Meehan. He was getting kids out of the locker. And I mean, that's only 1995, which is a long time ago, which is 30 years ago. But seeing stuff like that, or seeing, you know, a 13-year-old Sidney Crosby come to prospects and dominate, or, you know, just what we did with the USHL was really helpful. Like, I mean, they were an older, heavier league at the time, and now they're a younger league, and helping with that transition was really important. And, you know, with the USPHL, I mean, I took over from Richard Gallant. I mean, they took a big risk when they decided to leave USA Hockey They gathered up a bunch of other leagues throughout the country. It was big. We expanded somewhat, nothing like what they are today, but we expanded somewhat to give people travel partners to provide security. You know, we took the league outside of the United States. We created a premier division in Ontario and Canada. So like there's a ton of things. I mean, helping people. Like I remember hanging out with a young Kyle Dubas, who was a player agent at the time, and he was kind of just hanging around, right? You could tell he was really smart. You could tell he was going to go places in hockey. But like, I don't know, he was like 23 at the time, and he spoke like a 40-year-old. You know, so hanging around people like that was a lot of fun.
One of the most and first, you know, attracted me to your name, Bob. Like I said, I do operate a team in the Eastern Hockey League, so we haven't had a ton of crossover, if any, really. But the one thing I was most impressed with was your management during the COVID year. All leagues were really stretched and had to really use all their resources and creativity and all their manpower to come up with different ideas to keep hockey going. You created a spot in Florida. Tell us about that process a little bit.
So I'd come in October. So COVID was in full swing. I can take some of the credit for COVID. The executive committee.
I hope you can't take some of the credit for COVID.
No, not COVID. Exactly. Correct. Thank you.
I get you locked up, buddy.
I can take some of the credit for the, we called it the hub, but certainly not all. We had an executive, the commissioner of the USPHL was Richard Gallant. Him, along with the other executive committee members, they didn't want to give up the year. They were dogged. And we started bantering around where we could possibly do something. I remember one of the executive members came and said, "Hey, I saw rooms in Vegas for $29. I mean, we can get ice there." Okay. Like that was how it all started. And if you remember at the time during COVID, you just couldn't count on governments to keep things open.
Sure.
Right. And there was one place where we could keep things open, and that's where I live, or one of my homes where I live and my residence, which is in Florida. And I live in Tampa, Florida. And I knew all of the facilities there, and there was a resort that, like all the other resorts, was probably going to go out of business, and we kind of kept them in business, and it was a real team effort. I mean, once we got there, I ran it, but it was a team effort to get us there. The owners of the various teams, not all the teams went there, but certainly all the NCDC teams went there. Their premier teams went there. We had premier teams from around the country that went there. So all the owners deserve a lot of credit. But I would say it was the executive committee along with myself that kept it going. And I can tell you, while the world was shut down, we always said that any kid that was in that hub, I mean, COVID changed everybody's lives, but they'll say, "I was playing hockey in Florida while everybody else was shut down." Like the OHL was shut down. The Western League was shut down. The Quebec League was shut down. Like everything was shut down, right? And we were going. And I mean, it was fun. Like, I mean, we had our own bus system there. I mean, we had our own it was a resort. We took over the resort. We had the cafeteria going there. There were some wild stories towards the end. Nobody got hurt. We all made it out, and we all finished the league. And when we came back, again, we were creative. I mean, our playoffs were always in the New England area. We ended up finishing the premier level down in Hampton Roads. We did our midget stuff in Pennsylvania. We just found spots where we could make it work. And we got it to the end of the year. There's a million stories like I could tell you in all of the ventures, whether it be the O or the USHL or prospects or whatever. There's stories like that everywhere, but COVID changed everybody's life.
Yeah.
And they kind of knew what, everybody knows what happened or where they were when COVID happened. There were 1,000 kids in Florida under the USBHL banner in COVID. It was crazy. No,
it was an amazing story. Like it's,
yeah.
When we first, in the EHL, when we first saw the reports of what the USBHL's idea was, you know, a lot of operators poo-pooed, but me as an operator, I was like, brilliant. Again, you know, USPHL was staying ahead of the curve. And that's one of the areas that I find fascinating about the USPHL and certainly your involvement with other leagues is their ability to think ahead of what the future is going to look like. You referenced the EJ and the USHL back in 2005, 2010-ish. The EJ was always a younger league. They always wanted to get young players, keep those 15, 16, 17-year-olds on the East Coast. When the USHL now transitioned to become younger and put those quantifiers in their operational standards, it changed the dynamics of hockey. What do you think are some of like the most forward-thinking ideas that you've come across while being involved in junior hockey?
Certainly, I think the owners, I think it was like 2000 of the USHL deciding to go tier one. In America, that's a big change, right? They separated themselves from the other three leagues. So I would say from a junior hockey standpoint, that's the biggest one. The Butch Johnsons of the world, they really drove it to where it is. And of course, when things happened with the NHL, where they kind of really almost went out of business. When CompuWare and the development team left and the USHL took in the development program, it just took them to another level. I mean, obviously, listen, we're going through the time of our lives right now. Okay. This is the biggest change that's ever, like when I talk about big changes, I think about, 72, the first time the pros played the Russians. I think about 80, yep, when the kids beat the Russians. I think about 89 when the wall came down. I think about, and I forget the years, 2004, and I forget the other year, where there were lockouts in the NHL to get security in the game, so that all of the teams could move forward, not just the rich ones. Like, to me, those are the biggest events in my lifetime.
Yep.
But the rule change with the NCAA allowing CHL players ranks right up there. And where it's all going, everybody's made all kinds of predictions. We're starting to see things happen right now. We'll really see where the dust has settled in 3 years. But I think this is the biggest change that we've ever seen. And I think to your question about forward thinking, out of the gate, I thought the CHL was so far ahead of Division One hockey as far as their messaging, what they were doing. I still haven't heard a message from any of the commissioners in Division One hockey. Okay. I don't know what division there's. So there's a, in the CHL, off on the ice, they want to beat each other up. Off of the ice, they are a band of brothers. They work together and their goal is to get all of the very best players who are eventually going to play in the National Hockey League to play in the CHL. Okay. In college hockey, I don't know what they have. Like, I'm talking Division One hockey now. They don't have a leader. Who's the leader of Division One hockey? They don't have a president. They have commissioners of each conference. Okay. Yep. But they don't have any leader saying, guys, this is where we have to go, or this is where I'm suggesting we go. And then they debate about it. And then they all are a band of brothers off of the ice going in that direction. So what's going to happen? I don't know. Like, I mean, if you follow our pod with Dan Kay, you know, we've made some pretty bold predictions. You can see that this, the CHL is going to make up 50% of the players in NCAA. Yeah. They're going to all the best player. The vast majority of best players are going to go to the CHL.
That's the shocking thing, Bob, is, you know, and I know Trevor's got a bunch of questions for you, and this would be my last question for a little bit, but that was the most shocking thing is that everybody anticipated the age outs from the CHL, then going through to NCAA hockey. I don't think with the NIL money that they really anticipated top 17-year-olds now going to college hockey who are underagers. I didn't, and obviously you hear Gavin McKenna is committing to Penn State. That's out of the blue and totally something that was not expected, I think, by most observers.
Well, so for me, dealing with the exception of the USPHL, my entire life I've dealt with nothing but the very best players who are hitting to the NHL. And all I was concerned about or cared about was who's going to win this battle to house the best players before they turn pro. Okay. Yeah. And I said right from the very beginning, I said two things. All the best players at 16 and 17 are heading. When I say all the vast majority of the best players at 16 and 17 are heading to the CHL. All that matters is the 18 and 19 year olds. If the NCAA wants to be the developer of players for the National Hockey League, they have to go after the kids who are 17 and 18, who are turning 18 and 19, okay, and get those players. Hmm. And we have a tracker. If you go to the Dan Kay website, here's a shameless plug for you. But at the top of the Dan Kay website, we have a CHL NCAA player tracker. And you could track every player that flips from the CHL to the NCAA. Or we track all the Americans to see how many are going to, you know, Canada. Or we're tracking the 2004 and 2005 NHL drafts. What's happening with those players before they sign? My favorite one, I think, there is the 2009 tab for Americans. Because these are the fresh kids who haven't really been touched yet. And so what we've done there is we kind of just took a scouting services ratings of the best Americans, and then we put columns for National Development Team, USHL, Western League, Ontario League, Quebec League, okay? And we put where all the kids are drafted. So some kids are drafted in three places. They're chosen for the development team, they're drafted, say, by the Western League, and they're drafted by the USHL. Well, who wins the battle? Okay, so I want to really track, okay, what's going to happen with this rule change, and we'll see. We'll see what's happening.
Right now, as you say that, I'm looking at this tracker, and wow, you guys are really being very intricate with everything you're doing and all the details, and it's definitely quite the endeavor that you guys are working on here, but that's fantastic. I mean, that's
overwhelming.
At least, well, I'm sure it is, but at least someone's doing it. You know, my question actually was going to be in regards to, and it looks like it's part of the, you know, you guys with the Dan Kay show, but do you mind sharing a little bit about your hockey 101s that you guys do?
Sure. So when the rule change happened, we said they're good broadcasters. I'm a terrible broadcaster, but after going through where I've been, I have a unique knowledge of all the levels. I've been at all the levels, and
right,
you know, I've tried to talk kids into playing in the USHL. I've tried to talk kids into playing into the OHL. I can't tell you how many rules might have been bent with NCAA coaches at prospects trying to get kids to go Division I. I mean, so it's just a field of interest of where players go that, you know, and making the predictions of what's going to happen, that we said, okay, we're going to start a podcast. And we started out with basically a baseline of, here's the history over the course of the last 30 years. Here's where we're at as far as numbers in the NHL right now, from the CHL, from the NCAA, from Europe. Here's the nationality and the ages of all the Division I prospects. Now let's see that the rules changed. Let's see what's going to happen. And we're seeing, right, if you go there, like there's a tab there that's a summary page. I'm not on it right now, but I believe the nationality prior, there were 486 freshmen in the NCAA last year. And the numbers were something like 56% were American, 30% were Canadian. And if you take a look at just the commits, okay, since the rule changed, basically those numbers have flipped. Okay, yeah. So we'll replace those commits with true freshmen, and we'll compare starting rosters at the beginning of the year to the starting rosters last year. Okay, and see what it, because some of those commitments are going to be coming in 26, 27, 27, 28. So let's see. You know, there's a summary there about what the leagues that are supplying Division One with their players. And like people, since the rule change, people will look and say, wow, the USHL only has like 50 players and the NHL has more players than that. What people have to realize is, basically, everybody was a commitment already prior to the rule change in the USHL. So there were no more really to announce. The USHL is the best league in America. And so just following this stuff, you know, and then we come up with bold predictions. You know, I said 486 freshmen. Let's just round it to 500 because my math isn't so great. I started talking to Division I coaches, and Division I coaches said, 50% of the players are going to come from the CHL. Okay. So 250 are going to, if you listen to, these are 17 Division I coaches from every conference. If 50% are going to come from the CHL, that leaves 250 for all the other leagues that used to supply Division I. Well, I could tell you the USHL is going to have 200 guaranteed. They're not going to have the quality of 200 that they had before. Okay, I don't believe. We'll find out. The underlying numbers right now suggest that they're not going to have the quality. And if they have 200, that leaves 50 left for the NHL and the BCHL, which are each used to having 100. So, like, there's just an earth-shattering explosion happening right now, and we're all just tracking it on Hockey 101. That can be found on the Dan K Show if you just go to that on the web.
Yep.
And you'll find it all there. And by the way, I think podcast number 3, we made a prediction on what the CHL would do. And like, check that box, check that box, check that box. Okay. Now, to your point, Andrew, earlier, I think the CHL thought they were prepared, but they were prepared to get all the young players, but they weren't prepared to maybe lose some of the players that they're losing.
Yes.
And I think they're going to lose more. And I think if Division I had a plan, they're going to lose even more. You know, when the coolest kid at school comes with the newest Air Jordans, every other kid in his class goes home to his parents and begs to have the new Air Jordans, right? If Gavin McKenna, if he's saying that this is the place where it's bigger, it's stronger, it's faster, it's going to help me get ready for the National Hockey League, who's next after him? We'll find out.
Right.
Couldn't agree more.
What, that's, you know, that's great insight. And I guess this is another future loaded question, but what do you think, what type of trickle down effect do you think this will have for the players that, you know, were used to be on the cusp of Division One? You know, are they now trickling down to Division Three? And what about the players that were once, you know, typically labeled there? Where do they go now?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a push down because you have a recycling of players, right? You're going to have 250 CHL kids that could never play Division One that are going to get a second kick at the can and take those spots away from kids who, so 250 kids it's going to be a push. And so what's going to happen at the USHL? I believe the USHL is going to still have their commitments, but they're going to have weaker commitments. What's going to happen to the BC League and the North American League, which were the next two strongest? They're going to be Division III feeders with the odd Division I kid. What's going to happen to the NCDC Premier EHL? They're going to have some D3 kids, and they're going to have club hockey kids. I mean, that's what's going to happen. I debate it with you guys if it's going to happen a different way, but I don't see how it happens a different way.
No, I think we're all in the same agreement, but right. I guess my last question would be, you know, you've talked about, you know, seeing all these young players and being a part of all this, especially at the USA Hockey level. Let's say you have a young player, 16 years old, who's talented as ever, comes up to you and says, you know, Bob, what do I do? Where do I go? Where do I play? I've got options anywhere I want. Where would you recommend them going?
So this answer for me has never changed, whether I was on the CHL side, the USHL side, the Division I side. First and foremost, they're young kids, and they need to be taken care of. Okay, they need to make sure that their education is still going in the right direction, because never forget, there's only a handful of kids in any birth year level that's going to make the National Hockey League and make real money. So education is the most important thing. So that's number one. And I think the longer somebody can stay at home under their parents' supervision, the better. Obviously, for a lot of kids, especially in America now, because there's so many non-traditional areas, and you just run out of the competition level, you know, in Nashville or Florida or where, I mean, you're going to have to move. But when you move, whether it's the CHL or the USHL or prep or, you know, wherever it is, again, is there supervision? I'm not talking about hockey here. Supervision? Are you going to have supervision to turn you in from an adolescent into a young adult that is going to be a responsible adult for the rest of your life? Is there still going to be a focus on education? Those things can never, ever change. Okay. And we all know there's all kinds of people out there that make promises that they're going to do that. And maybe a bunch of them don't follow through on that. But if I'm a parent, that's the first thing I'm saying. Here are my expectations. Here's how I would raise my son, okay? And I'm expecting the same from you. And if you don't give me that, because I'm going to be around, I might not be around for every game because I'm 1,000 miles away, but I'm going to be around and I'm going to be questioning my son. My son knows, and you know, that my kid's coming back home the second those things aren't required. That's the personal side, the non-hockey side. The hockey side, I believe you should play at a level that's going to push you to earn every inch of ice that you get without going over your head. Okay, so take a look at NHL first-round draft choices. They don't get thrown into the National Hockey League right away unless they're like a superstar, right? And they can handle it. Right. And even those kids are handled with kid gloves, right? They're put with the right line mates. okay, they're maybe not matched up against the other team's top two lines. I mean, they're like racehorses. You know, you just don't go to the Kentucky Derby. You have an allowance race, and then you go to a grade three stakes race, and then you got another prep race, right? So, but those kids need to be pushed. They don't need to be given something. I don't like it when people say, well, if I don't play in the first power play and penalty killing unit, I'm not coming to your place. I love that about Nick Saban at Alabama. I mean, his second squad might have been able to make the national final, right? Because their toughest games and their toughest competition was actually in practice most of the time. So find that spot right where they're going to take care of you personally. Find that spot where you're going to be pushed. Find that spot where you're going to be trained properly on the skills of the game, on the strategy of the game. That's what you should be looking for. And it's really hard because there's a lot of people that might bend the truth to get you to where they want you to go, not where you should go.
I mean, those are great answers, and that's sadly the truth of it all.
Yeah, great answers, Bob. My last question for you really would be, you know, I know you didn't form the NCDC and you weren't the formation of the USPHL, but you were really big. You had a huge influence, and your hand touched during a really difficult period to now see that league operating as it does now. It's a huge league. It seems like every week we're going through another expansion or they're introducing a new team. Just give us a little bit of your insight on was that your vision for the league, or is that a different vision for the league?
So when I was in the league and we expanded, we were really looking to expand at the premier level for travel partners and expenses, and because the player base would allow it. Okay. There were enough players to do that. The exception was in Canada. So at the time we had, I'm rounding the numbers now, we had 50 players from Quebec dispersed amongst the United States. There's a lot of hockey players in Quebec. And we had one team in Quebec 1 year, and it didn't affect the 50. The 50 were still dispersed. And of course, we had some owners and general managers saying, hold on for a second, I get my players from Quebec. What are you doing having a team in Quebec? It's going to hurt me. And it didn't hurt them at all. And then we expanded my last year there to just before I left, to having a 16 division there. And I did a number count, and it didn't hurt. They were still at 50 dispersed throughout the rest of the US. So that was a strategic expansion into a new country that could help the brand, I thought. The other place where we expanded was out west with the NCDC. prior to me getting there, they wanted that group, that mountain group, wanted to be NCDC. And it took us a while to get there. We did. They have some tremendous owners out there. I had so much fun working with them. So we were good there. When I departed the NCDC, let's choose my words carefully here. One of the reasons why, no, let me back up for a second, because this is interesting with you being in the EHL. When the EHL was leaving USA Hockey, is Joe Britannia still around?
No, he retired basically last May.
Gotcha. Well, I gave back then, so that's a couple years ago now, I gave Joe a call and said, listen, why fight? I mean, let's get together. And I really never heard anything back, but I thought that would be, and I know there were some personality things there because of how the USPHL started and the relationships with teams in the EJ, et cetera. Excuse me. But I was really hoping that that might help because there's a third tier three level of junior. And I thought the two together, working together, would be very advantaged if they could have gotten together. Of course, since I have left, things have really, really kind of gone crazy. everybody's calling themselves.
You said it first, officially.
That's crazy. Okay. Let's start with everybody calling themselves tier two. Okay. I don't care. Listen, call yourselves the Thank NHL you. For all I'm just kidding. Okay. It's when I think of tier two junior A hockey, I think of the Knoll back in the day. Okay. I think of, you know, here's a better way of saying it. When I think of tier two, I think of players going to Division I NCAA hockey. And there's nobody in those two leagues that are going to Division I NCAA hockey. So this fighting back and forth is just like crazy. Then, of course, I mean, some of the teams left the EHL and went to the USPHL. So there's a little bit of rivalry there. I still think they should all get together, but I don't know if they'd be able to do that. The expansion of the NCDC is, I think when, let's just say it's doubled since I've left.
Okay. I think it has.
I think it has to. Trevor, to your question about what's going to happen at the tier three level. Well, listen, players are going to want to play at the top level to begin with. They're going to want to play in the USHL or the CHL. Once they can't make that, they're going to come down to what they think, not what you call yourselves, what they think are the next levels. I'm guessing that's going to be the Knoll, okay, the BCHL, okay, that's what it's going to be, okay? And now after they get cut from there, then they're going to come down to the next level. The problem is in the USPHL, now there's 34, 35, I don't know, NCDC teams. Like, there's so many places for people to play. I mean, at that level. And some of them are, I mean, listen, when I was there, there was no tuition. Now there's tuition. Not for all the teams, but for some of the teams. I mean, so it's right. It's radically changed. And I'm not saying for the worse, for the better, it has radically changed. And I can tell you for sure at the tier three level, everybody was waiting for cuts before. I mean, there's going to be some scary situations, I believe, at the tier three level where teams aren't, I don't think some teams are going to make it to the starting line this year. We'll find out.
Well, okay. I agree with that.
There's only so many players to go around, right?
Yeah.
I'll just say this about the USPHL. I loved being there. I met so many. Yes, in every organization, there's going to be people that you want to punch right in the face. But I have to tell you, the people that I met in the USPHL, for the vast majority of them, they were wonderful people. They were trying to run businesses. They're businesses, just like the EJ, just like the Knoll, they're businesses. They were doing the right things. And I hope it works out for them. It's going to be tough at the premier level. It's going to be tough at the elite level. What do you call it at the EHL? What's the level, the next level down?
We have the EHL and then the EHL Premier.
Oh yeah, that's right. Very unique. You guys called it Premier.
It's trailing you. That's all.
Oh yeah, you call yourself whatever you want. I think for your EHL Premier and the USPHL Elite, I think it's going to be really tough. I think it's going to be really tough. You know, one of the things I found out when I was at the AAU National Championships for club hockey was, like, when I was talking to a lot of the coaches, A lot of their players don't come from junior hockey. They come straight from high school hockey. They come straight from double A hockey or triple A hockey. Okay. Why are these players and these parents, I just wonder, why are they going to spend an extra 2 years of tuition and all the expenses when they know where they're going to end up? Kind of, if I bring it all full circle, when Paul Coffey skated past me like I was standing still, I knew, and I didn't chase. And I think there's going to be a lot of kids that just say, I'm getting on with my life. I'll tell you, in Ontario, it happened. It was the OHL, a 16-year-old draft where you could draft a couple of 15-year-olds. When they went straight to a 15-year-old draft, and a really good player who's 15 years old, who doesn't get drafted, I mean, it hits you right in the face, right? And a lot of them keep chasing, and some of them make it, okay? But a lot of them, we found, just got out of the game. Yeah. And I worry for that. And I worry for that with this new thing that's happening in the U.S. with this, I don't know what they're calling it, the Super Midget League or whatever they're calling it, where they're going to have 30 to 40 tier one programs. And if you don't make one of those programs, if you're not making one of those programs at 15 or 16, isn't it really telling you where you're at in the hockey world? And I'm not saying every kid, but I think there's going to be a lot of players that are just going to say, you know what, I'm going to focus on academics. Maybe I'll play football instead of hockey. Okay. Maybe I'll do something else. We saw that in Ontario. I think you're going to see it in the United States. And the other reason I would say that, why you might see it in the United States, is because it's an expensive game to play, guys.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
You know? So we'll find out.
Barrier for entry is nuts.
Andrew, do you think you can take the lead and merge the USPHL and EHL together?
Rob, that's a question above my pay grade, but I appreciate you asking it. So, well, I appreciate your honesty and how open you are with the discussion. Obviously, a ton of insight and a ton of experience in the game, Bob. So, thank you very much for joining us on the Hockey Toolkit, and I hope to see you at a rink soon.
All the best, guys. Thanks for your time.